Hello and welcome to session 272. Join none of them, for they are all wrong. I'm Parker Blunt, and I'd like to briefly introduce the participants. First by name, John Remy, Phyllis Barber, David Yokestetter, and Bob Reese. Now, I have here a very long bio for each person. I'm not going to take the time to read it except my own. I will read that one. But I'll let you just simply refer to the program, which gives the essential kinds of things. A word about how this came about. Actually, I was reading. Well, what I do want to tell you this. Dave Yokestetter, Phyllis Barber, and I were all together at BYU, what was it, 10 or 15 years ago? And so we really are delighted to be back and sharing time together and renewing experiences here at Sunstone. John Remy is our youth speaker, and Bob Reese is the visiting high councilman. John has a blog which he calls Mind on Fire, and one of his entries was a description of attending another church, and it was really interesting. And about the same time, I had attended another church, which I'll describe to you briefly. And as I read John's entry and thought about my own experience, I thought that would really be an interesting Sunstone presentation. And I talked to John; he was willing to do it, and we recruited these other guys. And so I think it's going to be an interesting program. So let me begin with my paper. And then we will just follow right down the line. Is that okay, John? Okay, great. In March of 1875, my great-great-grandfather, newly ordained Baptist minister George A. Blunt, caught the train in Savannah, Georgia, his home, and traveled some 75 miles to Antioch Baptist Church in Tattnall County, Georgia, where he preached and baptized James Samuel Howard, his first baptism. 2 months later, he returned to Antioch and baptized the sisters Nancy E. and Macy Ann Kicklighter. On Sunday, June the 11th, 1875, he was back at Antioch, where he baptized 10 more. On March the 26th, 1876, a year after his first visit, he was again at Antioch, where he baptized 2 more. Then nearly a year later, on April 8th, 1877, he returned and baptized 3 more, one of whom was the 83-year-old John H. Smith. In between, he was visiting and baptizing at a number of country churches in surrounding counties. Sometimes he identified where the baptisms were performed, some in Mill Pond, some in the several rivers in the area. In September of this past year, my wife and I began the construction of a cabin on the Ohoopee River in Tattnall County, Georgia, on what the locals call Sandy Bluff. How we came to this spot has nothing to do with the fact that my dad was raised on a farm just 25 miles from where our cabin sits. It has everything to do with my wife tolerating my wish to live on one of the Blackwater rivers that meanders through the coastal plains of Georgia. After 2 years of looking at multiple lots on half a dozen or more of the Native American name rivers, the Alapaha, the Altamaha, the Ogeechee, the Satilla, among others, we found a place that seemed to fit our requirements on the Ohoopee. About the same time that we were settling in on Sandy Bluff, I acquired some of my great-grandfather's journals and records, one of which was his record of baptisms. When I discovered he had been to Tattnall County, I had the urge to see Antioch Church. I was pretty sure that if Antioch still existed, they would have a newer building than what they had in 1875. My idea, though, was to wander around the grounds of the place my ancestor had done his gospel work. I asked the librarian in town if she knew Antioch Church. She didn't recognize the name, so she called her 84-year-old aunt and asked her. She had a vague recollection of Antioch, but she didn't know where it was or even if it still existed. A few days later, on a Monday, I was talking to my neighbor, and she mentioned that she had attended a revival meeting the night before, and she was going again that evening. I asked her where, and she said Antioch Baptist Church. I told her how I had been looking for Antioch because of my connection with my great-grandfather. She invited me to go with her sister. I, after a bit of thought, agreed. I hesitated because even though my great-grandfather and my grandfather were Baptist ministers, I had never attended a Baptist meeting other than an occasional wedding or funeral. My father had jumped ship with the help of his Mormon wife, and my church meeting experiences had been largely LDS. Being accustomed to talks delivered in felt-wrapped monotones, I wasn't sure I was up to what I imagined would be an intense evening of revival preaching and calls to the altar. It turned out not to be at all painful. We arrived at church just before the meeting began at 7 o'clock. It turned out that I knew the minister of Antioch. The minister for most country churches have full-time employment, and like a Mormon bishop, do their church work on the side, so to speak. The minister for Antioch had brought his tractor to my river property to do some clearing for me as I was preparing to build the cabin. He's standing at the door, greeting people as they arrive, welcomed me warmly, and introduced me to the visiting preacher who would deliver the sermon at the revival meeting that evening. I stepped into the church, then turned and went back and told the minister that I was there because I wanted to see the place where my great-grandfather had come 130 years earlier. When the services began, Brother Kenny, as he was referred to, had me stand and he introduced me to the congregation, told them of my great-grandfather's visits and baptisms. Now I was part of the congregation. When I arrived home after the meeting, my wife asked me how it was. The only thing I could say was that it was fun. I don't know when I enjoyed myself so much. In fact, I insisted that my wife go with me the next night. It was fun, I think, because I was non-judgmental about what took place. There was a time when I would have been quick to hone in on the priestcraft that was sure to be found in this place. I would have searched for evidence of the insincerity of the people and false doctrine. I would have silently clucked my tongue because they had so little truth, and I would have lamented the spiritual shallowness of their lives. Call it a change in perception. Call it a paradigm shift. Call it a falling away. Whatever my state, I was content to let them believe whatever they wanted and practice their religion however they wished. I felt no need to make their religion any less than people coming together to worship in a way that addressed their longing for the sacred. Once there, I wanted to worship with them and to embrace whatever holiness I was prepared to find at Antioch Baptist. Brother Kenny began the services each night with, "It's good to be in the Lord's house, isn't it?" to which the congregation assented with amens and smiles and nods of approval. The Antioch version of the Lord's house was a modest-sized white frame building. It certainly wasn't the building the members constructed when the church was organized in 1845. I suspect there had been more than one building in the 160-plus years of its existence. The building had been recently remodeled, but it is still an old-style country church building, the rectangular-shaped, white-frame building set among ancient, moss-draped live oaks. The church grounds bordered agricultural fields. Across the road was a cemetery. The building didn't have a steeple, but the pitch of the roof was steep and pointed directly to heaven. The meeting opened much like an LDS meeting with a greeting, opening hymns, announcements, and invocations. The difference was in the tone. When Brother Kenny introduced me and told of my great-grandfather's visit 130 years earlier, he asked one of the men in the congregation if he knew the people my great-grandfather baptized. I didn't catch the man's response, but the people around him laughed. Earlier, Brother Kenny asked if there were people they needed to remember in their prayers, and several people mentioned people who were ill or had other concerns. After the congregation sang the opening hymn and the choir sang, someone suggested it would be nice if the congregation sang another hymn. After some discussion, they settled on "How Great Thou Art," the only hymn with which I was familiar. What I witnessed in these two meetings at Antioch was a group of people who had total responsibility for that little church. Even the meeting seemed to take shape to some extent as they went along. And for 170 years, successive generations have been successful in maintaining their place of worship. One man who introduced himself to me was the great-great-grandson of one of the founders. Later, I met his sister, who had returned home after living and working in Savannah for many years. There was a sense of belonging to Antioch that is different from the way Mormons belong to the LDS Church. I wish I could give a clear explanation to what I sensed as a difference in the nature of that belonging. I think at Antioch they felt a sense of ownership for the congregation, whereas Mormons tend to belong because the church owns them. Maybe that's a little steep. It is just that no one sets any geographic boundaries for the Antioch Baptist Church, where if you live within the boundaries, you must attend, and if you live outside the boundaries, you cannot attend as a regular meeting. The congregation chooses their pastor, and they determine their programs. Now, you can argue that isn't the Lord's way. Maybe it isn't. But it does produce a different sense of belonging and a different sense of what it means to worship. Their visiting preacher, Brother Wayne, knew how to work the little country church congregation. By that, I don't mean he was insincere, but he definitely was a performer. He would speak for a while with a subdued tone sounding for the world like an LDS general authority reading his talk from the teleprompter at General Conference. Then he would begin to raise the pitch and intensity, hitting the high peaks of religious intensity, only to slide back down to a lower level, allowing the congregation to rest and anticipate the next round of intensity of the Spirit. Brother Wayne preached a fine sermon that first night on salvation by grace. "You aren't saved because you're good," Brother Wayne would say, steadily raising your voice. You aren't lost because you're bad." The pitch is increasing now. "You do bad things because you're unsaved. You're good because you are saved," he's shouting now. There are some amens from the congregation. "And you tell it, preacher." "Let me repeat it," Brother Wayne says. "Your behavior doesn't determine your state of grace. Your state of grace determines your behavior." Then he begins to slide down. "I'm just telling you what's in the Bible. Jesus has the power to save. We don't have the power to save ourselves. It's right there in the Bible." They had all heard it before, but they loved hearing it. The truth be told, I'm partial to salvation by grace myself. I love the unadorned simplicity of confessing Jesus and being saved and having your life transformed. If we were to have a vote on salvation by grace or salvation through obedience, I would surely vote for salvation by grace. Beginning in the 1970s, the LDS Church increasingly was labeled a cult and declared a non-Christian religion. This was particularly true in the Southeast, where you would often encounter church marquees announcing a program on Mormonism. During that time, I sat in what was then called a regional council meeting. Members of the stake presidency, including the clerks and executive secretaries of the region, would attend the meeting conducted by the regional representative of that region. I recall one such meeting where there was a discussion of Protestant thinking we were not Christians. The consensus was that we needed to somehow get the word out that we weren't Mormons, but members of the Church of Jesus Christ. Yet the very name of the church were more conspicuous than others would understand that we indeed were Christians. We didn't grasp it at the time that they were aware of our official name, but their problem with us was that our conception of Jesus was quite different from their view of Jesus. In spite of the church's efforts to make both the name of the church and Jesus more visible, I think we still don't get much of what the Christian world sees as problematic with the Mormon version of Christ and salvation. I mention this because of my experience at Antioch those two nights. One of the things that was abundantly clear was that Jesus was the center of the religion. Everything was about Jesus, period. Jesus and Him crucified was almost the whole of the doctrine. One night, several weeks before I attended the meeting at Antioch, I was reading in the 8th chapter of Acts. Philip engaged a eunuch in conversation, and as they ride along in the eunuch's chariot, Philip preached unto him Jesus. Later, the eunuch said, "Here is some water. Why don't you baptize me?" Philip asked him if he believes with all his heart. The eunuch answers, quote, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God," end quote. Philip baptizes him. I thought to myself as I read it, and I have read it many times, that is the briefest baptismal interview I have ever heard. A little later, I was telling my brother about Philip's one-question baptism interview. No word of wisdom, no tithing, no allegiance questions, just do you believe in Jesus? He told me of a dream that he had once had. He was having a temple recommend interview, and it was with a general authority. The general authority asked him, "What is your testimony?" In his dream, my brother answered, "Of Jesus." The general authority began filling out the recommend, and my brother asked, "What about the other questions?" The general authority replied, "That is the only question that matters." A few weeks after my visit to Antioch, I attended a long weekend program on spiritual direction at an Episcopal center in the mountains of North Carolina. At one of the sessions, we listened to Friar Bruce, Carmelite and Catholic priest, speak on discernment and the Ignatius tradition. Ignatius of Loyola was, of course, the founder of the Jesuits and a saint in the Catholic Church. Afterwards, as I was walking along with my Baptist friend whom I had met there, I said, "You know, it seems to me that the Catholics and the Mormons have a lot of people, a lot of saints they have to keep up in the air, but the Baptists are only concerned with Christ." Whether my perceptions are correct or not, I did come away from Antioch experience thinking that, in fact, the Mormon worship of Christ is quite different from the Baptist and other Christian churches. It isn't just a matter of the Trinitarian versus three distinct personages where we differ. It has more to do with where we place Him in our gallery of people to follow. The next night of the revival, Brother Wayne told the congregation they had to move from Calvary to Pentecost. Too many Christians are stuck at the cross, he told them, and they don't make that long walk to Pentecost where they experience the cloven tongues of fire. He went on to preach about embracing and living by the Spirit. As I left that night, shaking his hand at the door, I said, "You're putting some pretty heavy food on these folks' place." He said, "Brother Parker," and I was impressed he remembered my name from the night before, "I think Christians are starving to death for some real substance. I try to give them something to chew on." How do I assess my experience at Antioch? I experienced something there I don't experience in LDS meetings. I didn't find anything disagreeable or that I thought an abomination, unless it was the modest, unsolicited contribution my wife and I made to Antioch. I liked the simplicity of the worship service and the involvement of the members. I liked that it felt like a worship service. While we were building the cabin and more or less camping out, we ate out a lot. Virginia, who owns one of the cafes in town, has invited us several times to attend the adult Sunday school class she teaches at Friendship Baptist Church. Friendship is only a few miles from Sandy Bluff. Maybe one of these Sundays we'll go experience the Friendship's version of the gospel doctrine class. John.
I'm in the middle of a year-long religious experiment that I call my OC pilgrimage. I live in Orange County, California, and I set a goal to visit 25 pilgrimage sites and places of worship in and around the OC. After each visit, I write about my experience on my blog at mindonfire.com. I try to be generous and respectful, but candid in my reflections. I'm almost halfway through my pilgrimage, and I thought I'd share a few of the experiences with you, and I'm going to borrow liberally from the text of my blog in this presentation. Specifically, I'd like to share three of my experiences. My visits to the local AME church, a liberal United Congregational church, and the Orange County Quaker meeting. So the first place that I'm going to tell you about is the Christ Our Redeemer African Methodist Episcopal Church. When my daughter and I have a 9-year-old daughter, walked into the worship hall, the first thing we noticed was that we were one of a handful of white people. Actually, I'm half Japanese and she's a quarter, but we look pretty white, among the 150 to 200 attendees. There's some irony here that this is actually the closest church to us because they meet on campus and we live on campus. And this is Orange County, where only 1 to 2% of the population is African American. And here was an African Methodist Episcopal church right in our backyard. Where the choirs of OC Christian churches I've visited have what I call the token black singer, sometimes the only African American in the congregation, which might have hundreds of people or even thousands in the mega churches, this one had a token white guy in the congregation. I was amazed at the energy that pervaded the meeting. The organ played constantly, even during prayers. The choir interjected sung praises, and audience members would jump in with clapping or shouts of affirmation. I spent the first 30 minutes just grinning with the infectious exuberance before my smile muscles tired out. But none of this matched Pastor Mark's spirited enthusiasm. Mark Whitlock is a master preacher. His sermon, titled Deal or No Deal, focused on hypocrisy, illustrated by the story of Ananias and Sapphira from Acts 5. These were the ones who were struck dead in front of, he called them Pastor Peter, when they lied to him about their incomplete contribution to the church community. I really don't like this story, and was half aware of the fundraising thermometer and the pictures of the church that they were trying to build. They didn't want to meet in this lecture hall the whole time, so they were trying to build a church. And there was a picture of the construction prominently placed on the stage. But I was still completely enthralled by his message and his preaching style. He wove together a theological response to scholarly critics of the story, focusing on the sovereignty of God that appealed to my intellect. But he wove it together with a colloquial, emotionally charged delivery. I'm not even going to try to mimic this, but he said, "I just stopped by to tell you that God is not who we want him to be. I just stopped by to tell you that God is who he is." As he reached the climax of his message, his fervor reached a crescendo, and both he and many in the choir and congregation seemed to be caught up in a sort of a rapture. I can't for the life of me remember what he said, but I will never forget how I felt. I felt deep peace, anger, goosebumps, and enthusiasm, and a lot of other emotions in religious environments, but this was visceral, adrenaline rushing, heart beating, blood boiling, spiritually rioting with the crowd sorts of feelings. When he finished, he was sweating and breathing hard, like a boxer returning to his corner after the bell. Finally, later in the meeting, while we're all standing, he asked everyone who was saved to raise their hands up high. I kept mine down, though I suspected what would happen next. I just couldn't bring myself to raise my hand. So Pastor Mark says, "Look around you. Do you see anyone with their hands down?" He repeats this several times. I don't see anybody with their hands down. Bring them down here. So I was hoping no one would notice. No such luck. A tall man in his early 20s appeared behind me, smiling. "Brother, I didn't see your hand up," he said. He took me gently by the arm, and while the pastor called me and my daughter to stand in front of the whole congregation, and she and I kind of glanced nervously at each other, I can't remember what all the pastor said to me, but he acknowledged our nervousness and said that we would feel a miracle. Eventually, he called the entire congregation down to the front, where we were all crowded together facing the altar, and we prayed with the pastor's voice. Thankfully, my daughter and I were only a small part of the prayer. We were included and remembered in it, which I think focused a lot on sacrifice and the new church building. Still 3 months and $1 million from completion. This congregation is going to have to make some big sacrifices to build this, but this pastor really had a vision. My daughter was a trooper through this whole ordeal, and although we were both scared, my knees were trembling, I think I got more strength from holding her hand than she probably did from me. After sending everyone else back to their seats, he asked me, "Do you accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior?" I leaned forward and told him, "Me and God, we're working things out right now." He laughed and repeated it back to the congregation. A little later, as the congregation placed their offerings in a basket and filed past him, he gave us hugs, big hugs. When the meeting ended, my daughter and I walked out feeling a little shell-shocked. I was emotionally exhausted, but I left with a deep respect for Pastor Mark and his little flock and a new appreciation for a tradition of Christian worship very different from what we experience in the LDS Church. The next experience I'd like to tell you about is my visit to the Irvine United Congregational Church. I was privileged to witness a watershed event in the life of the Irvine United Congregational Church, IUCC for short, as they welcomed their new pastor and his partner of 20 years into their church family. I visited the IUCC about once per year since September 11, 2001. I attended interfaith events after 9/11, seeking for healing, and IUCC's then pastor, Fred Plimmer, wasn't afraid to be without answers in the aftermath. It takes a strong person to lead with uncertainty. I was intrigued to learn that many members of the congregation were gays who felt pushed out of LDS and other conservative Christian churches. And last fall, I enjoyed a program that was run entirely from the first prayer to the last bit by female high school members of the congregation. Reverend Plummer retired last year, and the IUCC spent several months engaged in an intense search for a new pastor. I timed my pilgrimage to IUCC to coincide with the job talk of the primary candidate and the subsequent vote. The members of IUCC meet in a geometric dome of a building. The sparsely decorated interior makes it possible for other faiths to share the meeting house. The university synagogue met there until they were able to raise funds for their own meeting house, and also one of the local Muslim groups has their meeting there. For our worship meeting, a simple cross and a couple of candles adorn the altar. Reverend Paul Telstrom got up to speak, and the first thing I noticed was he looked kind of like my mission president, who's now a general authority. And B, he was wearing pink robes. Later I learned that the robes were white, but the pink shade was from the lighting near the pulpit. But I thought that it did kind of highlight his same-sex orientation. And some of the other members of the congregation thought the same thing. This was the culmination of months of courtship between IUCC congregation and Reverend Telstrom. He performed magnificently. He proclaimed his pastoral emphasis on community over certainty and on his mission to reach out to those who felt excluded and marginalized. When he said that, quote, "I believe in taking back the symbols of the church and giving them back to those who are on the margins and not reserving them for those whose surety draws too small a circle," he was interrupted by enthusiastic applause. When he affirmed with great authority that "you have a purpose," I could almost feel the collective straightening and energizing of the congregation. I loved his benediction at the end of the meeting. "May God take your lips and speak truth to them. May God take your hearts and set them on fire." The new pastor had spoken as a true leader, with a perfect mixture of humor and seriousness, authority and humility, passion and reason. The meeting was over, and he left the building, but the climactic moment was still a few minutes away. The next part fascinated the Mormon in me. Our leaders are always chosen for us by another man, through inspiration. In the business meeting that followed, the congregation followed parliamentary procedure, and the head of the search committee detailed the arduous process of seeking and wooing the potential pastor. They placed ads, sought recommendations from informed and connected people in the greater UCC community, read resumes, listened to sermons, visited churches and events, checked references, and spent countless hours in interviews and in prayer. They felt that they were indeed led by the Spirit of God on their search. Then they presented Telstrom's name for a vote. Over 100 hands held up the bright yellow cards in his favor. Not one voted against. The vote was unanimous. The feeling was euphoric, like being on the side of a winning team after a championship soccer game. The congregation gave the search committee a long standing ovation and then enthusiastically welcomed Reverend Telstrom into the life of their church. I wish I could capture the feeling I had in that moment, even as a non-attached bystander, and convey it to you. I cannot imagine how it felt to the members of that church to finally have a father again, one who promises to unify their diverse community. The final meeting I want to tell you about is the Orange County Meeting of Friends. Liberal Quakerism is in many ways the antithesis of modern Mormonism, which is probably why I like to escape to the local meeting on occasion. Jana shares my sentiments. She said many times that if she weren't born into the LDS church, she'd be a Quaker. The OC meeting, the Orange County Meeting of Friends, meets in downtown Santa Ana on the second floor of a rundown office building. They could have chosen to meet in a nondescript suburban strip mall or office park, but instead they chose to situate themselves in a very urban environment. And they actually, a lot of their service is supporting members of that community in which they worship, even though most of the attendees come from suburban Orange County. Most of the meeting takes place in a small room on inexpensive but comfortable chairs arranged in a circle. So what do you do at a liberal Quaker meeting? You sit. That's it. Well, and you also listen. And sometimes, when led by the Spirit, you speak. But mostly you just sit and listen. It's like a testimony meeting, except with the silence and the speaking reversed. And they don't get uncomfortable in the silences. You know, you get that feeling you get in testimony meeting where you're like, when is somebody going to get up and talk? No, it's the opposite. The quiet sitting is one of the things I feel appealing. I find appealing about the Society of Friends. For all my affinity to and the study of Buddhism, I have a hard time meditating in the Eastern Zen or Transcendental ways. Even though liberal Quakers are reluctant to espouse any creeds, you'll find them coming from Christian, Jewish, and even atheist backgrounds. The tradition is rooted in 17th century English Protestantism. I found that I love meditating in the Christian tradition. In my mind, Quakerism has a wonderful blend of accessible Christian mysticism. Yeah, the closest that we come to it actually isn't in testimony meeting, it's in during the sacrament, where there's a reverent silence, generally. So, there's a focus in Quakerism on the experience of that of God within every human. And there's many names for this. And it translates well into some of our Mormon terminology as well, when we talk about everyone who is a child of God. And then acting within the world on the revealed light and truth received. This is the tradition, though it has been relatively small in numbers throughout history, that produced William Penn and his great political experiment, suffragists like Susan B. Anthony, Lucretia Mott, prison and social reformers like Jane Addams and Elizabeth Fry, early U.S. patriots like Thomas Paine and Dolly Madison, and countless abolitionists and pacifists. Also Dave Matthews. And Walt Whitman was raised a Quaker. Note the number of famous female Quakers. I like that. This cutting-edge progressivism and powerful activism is the flip side of the silent, mystic Quaker coin. So here's a little Mormon-Quaker comparison. Where, and remember, I'm sitting in this meeting as, you know, as a Mormon, making these comparisons in my mind. Where Mormon men wear white shirts and dark suits, and women are required to wear skirts or dresses, Quakers dress comfortably in jeans and corduroy and a few pairs of Birkenstocks and flip-flops. This is part of the long tradition of being plain in appearance. Where Mormonism has a strong vertical hierarchy, Quakerism has got to be the flattest, most egalitarian of religions I know. Everything is run by committee, and from what I've heard and read, sometimes it's a miracle that things get accomplished. But there's something, it's also actually how they make decisions is a very unique, and Jan has experienced that more than I have. Whenever they come to a point where there's contention and disagreement, what do? They sit in silence. Where Mormonism has well-defined gender roles, there's no difference between male and female leadership in Quakerism. And where U.S. Mormon culture, especially during this time of war, can be heavily jingoistic, Quakers deplore war and emphasize the universal humanity of individuals before their citizenship. I tried to write this down and I couldn't, but I just want to share one experience. As I was sitting there, trying to meditate in the Quaker tradition, I had this experience of, I felt this light within me. And I thought, hey, this is what they call that of God within me. And then, as I meditated on that for a bit, I realized everybody else around me had that same spark of divinity within them. And pretty soon, my mind was expanding to encompass all of Santa Ana, all of Orange County, almost like pulling out and looking at the whole world and just seeing 6 billion lights. Huh? Sorry. All glowing. And this is where that activism comes from. They sit in silence and wait for God to reveal this truth to them. And then when they realize it, they're like, I can't war against these people. I can't let these people suffer in hunger or injustice, inequity. And so I'm glad I didn't write that down. In conclusion, these represent just three of my pilgrimage experiences. I could tell you about so many more. I've watched the scrolls of the Torah adorned and paraded like royalty through the Jewish temple. I've chanted praises to the Bodhisattva Amida in a Japanese Buddhist temple. Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu. That was a great experience because it connected to my mother and her heritage. I've watched reverently as tearful Catholics kiss the feet of the crucified Savior on Good Friday. I've had a wonderful bonding experiences as members of my family have joined me on my quest, such as when my daughter and I took a meditative walk through a labyrinth at a local church on Easter. So I'm going to close with a testimony of sorts here. Through my visiting of other churches, I've gained a deep respect for other people's religious expressions. There's no way I can belittle them. In fact, I have a deep reverence for the religious expressions of others. I've gained some beneficial practices and values that weren't very strong in me or that I wasn't aware of beforehand. I actually have I didn't expect this, but I have a stronger sense of my own value of my Christian heritage, which I had thought I was more universal, but I really do value that. And I think I call myself more of a Christian than I did, say, a year or 2 years ago. And now I also have multiple what I call church homes, places where I can go visit and feel at home. We've gone back to IUCC. They had a great thing on Hiroshima recently that was very moving. Anyhow, I'm eating up my time here, so I just wanted to say that what a wonderful experience this has been. I encourage all of you, if you haven't had a chance to go out and just visit a few other churches, go in, reserve your judgment, and just kind of experience it and see what you come away with. Thank you.
I grew up a Mormon child whose father was bishop in Boulder City, Nevada. And we were always told not to tell people that we were Mormon because there was a lot of anti-Mormon sentiment there. But I was always curious about all the other religions in this community. We had a community church that had a Bible school every summer, and I just begged and begged and begged to go because they made shields and swords and knight kind of things, you know. And I really wanted to do that. And there was a Catholic church that the priest was purported to go out drinking at Railroad Pass Casino on Saturday nights. And of course, I expected nothing more from the great and abominable church, right? But I really didn't believe that, actually. And I wanted to go to catechism. I wanted to learn about that. But one other thing, when one of our high counselors was named Berkeley Bunker, and he had grown up in the Southern Baptist tradition, so when he would speak, he would do this sort of monotone and go up high, like just like Parker was talking about. But one time he was speaking and he was leaning into the podium. He says, "Do you want to go to the celestial kingdom?" And this little boy in the audience said, "No." But anyway, we always loved it when the Bunker brothers would speak because it was much more interesting. But the 13th article of faith has always been something that feels it opens great doors. We believe all things, we hope all things. If there's anything of good report or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. So I always felt that I could learn from other perspectives, and that I did. There were holy rollers down the street. There was the bar mitzvah of my friend. There was all kinds of things going on. It was a wonderful place to grow up. And as a young woman, I became interested in the Tao Te Ching and many Buddhist readings. And anyway, I always felt very inspired by the remarks from people from other cultures. But then I got very involved in being Mormon. And when you're very active, you don't have time really to go to other churches because you go to your, especially now that it's a 3-hour block. You have that, and there's no way you can go. But Jonathan has obviously done it. I was very active in the Mormon Church until I was about 40 years old, and then my husband and I began to have some problems, and it became a war ground. Basically, he wanted to stay home, I wanted to go to church, and it became a really bad thing on Sundays. So I decided that my family was more important than this arguing about church, so we decided we'd look for something else where we could go together and wouldn't have to argue about it, or feel guilty. He wouldn't have to feel guilty. That's a better way to talk about it. So we tried the Church of Religious Science, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with Unity and Religious Science, but the founder is Ernest Holmes, who wrote a book called Science of Mind, and it's actually a fabulous book talking about how our minds are different levels of perception. And anyway, I'm not going to go into that right now. But I found it was really great. And the preacher was named Reverend Al, and this was in Salt Lake City. Do you remember Reverend Al?
He married
us. Oh, you're kidding. Wow. Well, Reverend Al was just awesome. He was fabulous. And he was so much fun to go listen. And they met at the Organ Loft in Salt Lake City, so they had this big circus organ. And I always loved this big music, you know. So anyway, they play this great music on the organ, and Reverend Al was just full of life. And when he passed away, they had his funeral was, everybody had balloons and they released them at the end, and it was great. I loved it. And then we also tried, but then when somebody tried to replace Reverend Al, it just didn't work as well. So that was, of course, what we were always told in the Mormon Church, that it wouldn't work as well because of this. And then I tried the Lutheran Church for a year. David and I tried the Lutheran Church in Colorado. And the minister was fabulous. He was very well-read, well-thought man. But the hardest thing was they asked me to substitute to play the organ once in a while, and it was so frightening because I didn't realize how used I was to our ritual, the schedule, the procedure of the meeting, and it was like I was always going, oh, there's a liturgy. I don't know what a liturgy is. So what I realized was how accustomed I was to my Mormonness and to the meetings and how comfortable they were. But anyway, when David and I finally divorced, I moved to Denver all by myself, and I couldn't go to the Mormon church because I just didn't feel right about going somehow, even though we were not together. And at that time, I didn't feel I would really be welcome there, or that, you know, I just didn't have a good feeling about going back there, which was not the smartest thing for me at the time. But I started attending African American churches, and I think partly because being divorced, I felt, never think you're going to have feelings about these things. Anyway, I felt like that I was a second-class citizen somehow. And so I really got in myself in a kind of a difficult hole for a while. But and somehow going to worship with the Black brothers and sisters whom I felt had struggled so much in their lives, I just felt this real community. And I felt sort of an equality there that blessed me in many ways. But I loved the music so much, and I loved the big robes and the choir coming down the aisle. I really do love that. And I started attending a church called the Heritage Christian Church in Denver. And they had a big sign outside that said, "Sinners, welcome here." And I just thought, this is great, you know, I'm going. So I started going there, and it was great. And one of the things I remember that the minister said, he says, "I don't care," and this is mostly about, it's a huge church and mostly Black, although it was a Caucasian minister. But he said, "If you've been a prostitute or a drug addict or wherever you've been," he says, "I don't care, but your job is to repent and help others who are in the same predicament." And I thought, that's remarkable. I really loved that, and that's been something that's helped me. I actually, like Parker said, I felt the strong testimony of Christ there. There was a different worship of Jesus. And at one time, I was very depressed. I'll confess this. I was really low. So I'd go to this church on Sunday mornings, and they had the best musicians in Denver. Guitars, drummers, choir. And you walked in, and you felt like, all right, you know. And it was something about the rhythm and all the feeling there. And I just felt like, so blessed by getting to go there. And I gained a testimony that I didn't have of Christ in my attention. And I went to lots of different ones. I went to African Methodist Episcopal and Second Baptist in Columbia, Missouri, and went to a charismatic Baptist church where the women you'd get the spirit and faint, and they even had a cloth to cover up their legs if the women fell down. it was wonderful, and I instead of being an observer there, I was a participant, and that to me made all the difference in the world because I really needed these people. I needed the way they were looking at the world because I was sort of lost at the time, and they helped me, and I felt it was a technicolor vision of tithing, a technicolor vision of Christ. It was really alive, and I loved it, and it has served me. I now I'm attending the Parley Sixth Ward again in Salt Lake City, but this has just served me wonderfully and made me so much richer to have this experience. And I want to share one more of my experiences with the African Americans in Port Royal, South Carolina. I'd gone back there with a friend, and I said, "The only thing I want to do is visit one of the churches there, and you can do anything else you want on the weekend." So he helped me find that we drove around Port Royal, South Carolina, where the Gullah people were supposed to have come from. And anyway, we found this little tiny clapboard church that needed painting, and pulled up, and there was a van out front, and Bill went over to the driver, and he turned out to be the minister. He said, "Well, would it be all right if we came to church here?" And he said, "Sure." And so then Bill decided not to go because he felt he would be an observer rather than a participant. But one of the stories that this was very meaningful to me at this time. There was a woman named Mama, and she was asked to give the opening prayer. And I don't remember all of the prayer, but the part that stayed with me so deeply was, she said, "Thank you for the lying down at night and the rest. And thank you for the rising up in the morning. And thank you for the blood that runs through my veins and gives me life." And I thought, you know, that's just about what it's all about. And so I am really totally grateful for my experiences. I could speak about Buddhism and how that's been helpful as well, but I won't continue on. But I think that, again, to participate with other religions as a participant is a valuable thing, instead of going with your comparative eyeglasses on to say, "Oh, well, this isn't right because it's not like this," or "this isn't," but to go in and to be there with whomever you choose to worship with. So, thank you.
I've really enjoyed this. Thank you, Parker. My personal experience with other religions is relatively limited. I have found my experience is significant. I actually grew up in a middle-class, predominantly Jewish neighborhood in Los Angeles. And when I went to elementary school, virtually all of my friends, 90% of my friends, were Jewish. In fact, when we had the high holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, there'd be maybe in a class of 25, two or three kids. And I think some of those might have been Jewish. But anyway, I was really interested in my friends, their religion. I went to a lot of bar mitzvahs and to temple during those times. And one of the things that really stands out in my mind about this experience is how tolerant these people were. Now, of course, Jews don't proselyte, so there was no emphasis or need for me to change my religion or be anything different than I was to associate with them. I'm sure that, particularly my friends in elementary school, that I was probably one of the few Christians that they knew, and certainly I was the only Mormon that they knew. And the tolerance was so great that as I thought back on my entire 12 or 13 years from kindergarten through high school, I can only remember one derogatory remark that was made about my religion from a friend of mine, and I don't think that was intentional. These were wonderful people. The only other foray that I've had into other religions occurred about 11 years ago. And it was a time when I was going through an experience that I didn't think I'd ever go through in my life. I had considered in my very unconscious Mormon state that I had a successful marriage. And until my wife of 27 years suggested that we had probably learned everything that we needed to learn together as a couple, and that she wanted to find other relationships, and particularly she wanted to find a new spiritual path for herself. And this was something that I was not prepared for. I was not at all ready for. Initially, her decision stunned me, and although I was aware that I wasn't a perfect husband and father, I thought I was pretty good, like maybe a B grade, not an F, I felt like I was getting at that time. And so, you know, I had been a conscientious provider. I had been an active priesthood member. I had held key positions in the church. You know, I had been a gentle and giving father, even though I was a little emotionally distant because I was doing so many other things. But I didn't realize, until after I reflect upon this, and when I was single, that I was missing something, that there was a passion, an intimacy, an emotional and spiritual connectedness that I really did not develop. But I really had no model for that. I didn't see it in my family. I didn't really learn about it. I didn't feel in my church or in my environment. So the last 11 or 12 years, I've been on an enormously steep spiritual and emotional learning curve. And during that time, I was the principal guardian and caregiver for our youngest son from ages 8 to 18. I had been in some long-term and significant relationships, and I have really broadened my religious and spiritual perspectives during that time. So it has been a real growth experience. That has been a very powerful experience for me. At the time of my separation, I had two major contacts with religious organizations within a week or two of the time that we separated. The first was my high priest group leader called me, and he invited me to go out to lunch with him at the Sizzler here in downtown. And we went out to lunch, and he was a really loving and gentle man. He had been formerly a bishop, as I had been. But we had a very businesslike meeting. Really what we discussed at that meeting is how to manage my relationship with the ward. I had moved to an apartment just a few miles out of the ward, but I wanted to stay in the ward because I wanted my son to continue to interact with his friends within the ward. So I requested that I could remain within the ward, my membership in the ward, and I also requested that I could be a primary teacher. So I could also be with my son at this time. But other than that, this conversation that we had was, like I say, very businesslike, no pastoral love or concern extended, no condolences, and no sympathy. But I didn't really expect that. That was not, and I wasn't disturbed by that. I just sort of thought that this was the way it was, and when I'm in the situation I'm in, it's sink or swim for me. And I really believed that. The requests I made of my high priest group leader were eventually granted, which I felt really grateful for. And during the next few years, my major contact with the ward was with these women that were in the primary. And they were very gentle and kind to me, and extremely understanding. But other than that, I never have had any kind of pastoral services extended. I never had an interview with bishop or my high priest group leader since that time. Maybe that's unusual. But that was my experience. Once again, this did not disappoint me. And really from the perspective that when I was a bishop, there were a few active couples in our ward who dissolved their marriages. And I don't think that I extended or was any more effective in pastoral services at that time for them than what occurred to me. I mean, I had never been divorced. I virtually hardly knew anybody that had been divorced. I really had no experience around that, and I only had judgment and conditioning about it, which isn't very helpful. So that was my experience with in our church. And the other contact that I had was from Hannah Knightum, and I had known Hannah Knightum, a very dear friend who I had met at the Unity Spiritual Center, which was a small non-denominational congregation that met around the Fort Union area at that time. And at the time that I was still married, but my wife was sort of disengaging from the LDS church, she started going to Unity, and I joined her frequently, and I became very acquainted with the congregants that were at the Unity Spiritual Center, Hannah being one of them. The call was to invite me to a dinner party that she was having a week or two hence, and I accepted, but I was speculating that Hannah was having this dinner party to get me acquainted with some of her other single friends, and I was not ready for that experience, and I was not looking forward to it. In fact, when I drove up to her house that night, it came late, and I was really dreading it, and but when I walked in, the atmosphere was totally different than what I anticipated. There were some single men and women that were my age, but there were also a few married couples that were there. There were about 15 people, and we sat down to dinner and around a large table, and at the conclusion of dinner, someone said something like, there's a reason why we're all here together in this dinner, and they said, this is no accident. And then the same person said, we each have a message for each other, and I would love to hear the message that each of us have. And so that evening, and everybody agreed to go ahead with this, and that evening we went around the table and we gave our messages. And I really don't remember precisely what anybody said. I have no idea what I said to the group, what my message was. But all I remember is that when we concluded that experience, I felt that that was one of the most powerful spiritual experiences I had ever had in my life. That these messages were simple, some were a little weird, you know, new age, but, you know, they were sincere and moving and very powerful. After the evening, Hannah asked me, or indicated, that this group of people actually, this was a kickoff meeting, this dinner, for a weekday study group that was really designed, was called Quest, and it was designed for spiritual transformation and rediscovery. And she asked me if I would like to be a part of that, that it was going to be it's a year-long program, and I'd have to make that kind of commitment. And I was very enthusiastic after that experience to do that. The Quest, though, it was a structured program. We had a manual that we read from. We also had a workbook that we generally did journaling and meditations every day. And, you know, I found this daily meditation workbook journaling to be very healing and cathartic for me. But the main part of this was meetings together. We met together, these 15 people, every week. And, and this became my support group. And these people were just transparent, open. We could say anything that we were feeling, and there was no scorn, no judgment. I just have never felt a bonding experience, anything like this experience that I had with this group of people. I actually went regularly to Unity for about 3 years, and I really enjoyed the friends that I met, and I really went there largely to fellowship with the people that were in my Quest group. But there were other things that were very attractive. I loved the music, contemporary, you know, upbeat. And also, during every service, we had a directed meditation, which I really enjoyed. Although I have lost contact with most of the people that were in the Quest group and with Unity, I will be eternally grateful for the Hannah Nightums and the Mark Coltranes and the Nancy Calls and the Judy Kennards that were, and others that were in this group. I mean, they just saved my life when I was lost emotionally and spiritually. And and I just really felt that I was guided to that experience. Thank you.
It's nice to be on the program with David, who was a bishop at UCLA when I was on a member of the faculty there, and later he was a member of our state presidency, so it's nice to hear his story. Let me begin with a story I heard from Coleman Barks, who is the translator of the great Persian poet Rumi. I attended a poetry reading not long ago in which Coleman Barks tells the story of the man who is shipwrecked on a South Sea island. And he's there for a long time, maybe 10 years, and he despairs of anyone ever finding him. But finally a ship comes by, and he sends up a smoke signal, and the ship stops and picks him up. And as the ship is sailing away, he and the captain are standing at the back of the ship looking back at the island. And the captain says, "I noticed there are three huts on your island. What are those?" And the man says, "Well, the hut on the left is my house, and the hut in the middle is my church. And the hut on the right is the church I used to belong to." I grew up in the church hearing negative comments about other churches. In fact, I can't remember ever having heard a positive remark about any other world church or any other Christian church. Sentiments about the Catholic Church were particularly strong, as were those of the reorganized church. The one was called the Whore of Babylon, and the other, though not called so-called, might as well have been called the Whore of the Restoration. At times, I still hear negative comments about other churches. This is a stark contrast to the messages we hear these days from church leaders. Elder Russell M. Ballard said recently, "Occasionally, I hear members offending those of other faiths. This kind of behavior is not in keeping with the teachings of the Lord Jesus Christ. I cannot comprehend why any member of our church would allow these kinds of things to happen. For the most part, our neighbors, not of our faith, are good, honorable people, every bit as good and honorable as we strive to be. They care about their families just like we do. They want to make the world a better place just like we do. They are kind and loving and generous and faithful just like we seek to be." Nearly 25 years ago, the First Presidency declared, quote, "Our message is one of special love and concern for the eternal welfare of all men and women, regardless of religious belief, race, or nationality, knowing that we are truly brothers and sisters because we are sons and daughters of the same eternal Father," end of quote. Elder Ballard continues, "This is our doctrine, a doctrine of inclusion. That is what we believe. That is what we have been taught. Of all the people on this earth, we should be the most loving, the kindest, and the most tolerant because of that doctrine." When I was director of studies at UCLA for three programs in England during the 1980s, it was then that I first discovered the beauty, the sincerity, and the integrity of other faiths. During those occasions when I would be in England, I would often go to church at Westminster Abbey, at St. Paul's Cathedral, one of the small parish churches that dot the London landscape, and then afterwards attend the Hyde Park Ward, or when I was in Cambridge, attending services at Christ Church or King's College, and then the Cambridge Ward. Those were interesting and enlightening experiences, experiences of contrast. I have worshipped in various places in my travels, St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice, Notre Dame and Saint-Denis in Paris, Russian Orthodox churches in St. Petersburg and other Russian cities, Buddhist temples and Shinto shrines in Kyoto and Tokyo, Jewish temples in Los Angeles and Santa Cruz, and a variety of Christian churches in Europe and the United States. When I first started visiting other churches, I felt as Emily Dickinson did when she went for walks in the woods. She said, "When much in the woods as a little girl, I was told that the snake would bite me, that I might pick a poisonous flower, or that goblins might kidnap me. but I went along and met only angels. My experience in worshiping in other churches have been universally positive. Often I've been spiritually fed, and at times even profoundly touched by these experiences. In speaking of how God regards other believers, Elder Orson F. Whitney said this remarkable thing: God the Father of us all uses the men and women of the earth, especially good men and women, to accomplish his purposes. It has been true in the past, it is true today, and it will be true in the future. Perhaps the Lord needs such men and women on the outside of his church to help it along. They are among its auxiliaries and can do more good for the cause where the Lord has placed them than anywhere else. Hence, some are drawn into the fold and receive a testimony of the truth, while others remain unconverted, the beauties and glories of the gospel being veiled temporarily from their view for a wise purpose. The Lord will open their eyes in his own due time. God is using more than one people for the accomplishment of his great and marvelous work. God is using not only his covenant people, but other peoples as well to consummate a work stupendous, magnificent, and altogether too arduous for this little handful of saints to accomplish by and of themselves. While the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is established for the instruction of men and women, it is one of God's instrumentalities for making known the truth. Yet he is not limited to that institution for such purposes, neither in time nor place. God raises up wise men and prophets here and there among all the children of men of their own tongue and nationality, speaking to them through means that they can comprehend. All of the great teachers are servants of God. Among all the nations and in all ages, they are inspired and appointed to instruct God's children according to the conditions in the midst of which he finds them, including in other churches. One of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism, he concludes, is to receive truth, let it come from whence it may, to gather all the good and true principles in the earth and to treasure them. Several years ago, when I was bishop of the Los Angeles First Ward, I went to Easter services at Westwood Presbyterian Church in Los Angeles. The minister there, Charles Orr, is a graduate of Brigham Young University and a friend of mine. When I was bishop, I performed a marriage and spoke at funerals in his church. As I sat there on that Easter Sunday morning, I was struck by a greater sense of reverence than exists in most Latter-day Saint wards. I think Latter-day Saints could learn something from other religions, how to treat our chapels more as sanctuaries, how to create a more reverent spirit in the space in which we partake of the emblems of the Lord's Supper. We might learn from Episcopalians how to make our worship services more elevated, how we might better, quote, worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness, as the scriptures invite us to do from Psalms 29. From Native Americans, we might learn how to have a greater reverence for the earth, how to nurture the natural world and treat all creatures with respect. From Buddhists, we might learn how to avoid too great a dependency on material things. From the Amish, we might learn how to simplify our lives, to better keep our eyes single to the glory of God. From the Quakers, as has been spoken of here, we could certainly learn more how to be a more peace-loving people. We could incorporate into our community service something of the Jewish concern for social justice. Wherever I have witnessed or participated in services of Buddhist temples in China and Shinto shrines in Japan and Orthodox monasteries in Russia, churches and cathedrals throughout Europe, or to numerous churches and synagogues in America, these experiences have deepened my own faith, expanded my love of God and Christ, challenged my spirituality, and given me a greater appreciation for other religions as well as for my own, and helped me to understand how much faith of all believers contributes to the goodness of the world, and how much it comprises the leaven in the loaf of the world. In short, I feel blessed to associate with people of faith and goodness wherever I encounter them. I have long been puzzled by Joseph Smith's report of being told that the creeds of other churches were an abomination to the Lord, mainly because so much of the creeds of the dominant churches of that time and this time have so much in common with what we believe and hold as sacred. Nevertheless, there were creeds that I think the Lord could not be pleased with. Those that taught that we were predestined. Those that taught that we were sinners in the hands of an angry God. Those that taught that slavery was ordained of God. Joseph Smith taught a very liberating theology. But so much of what Joseph Smith taught was also what he learned from other churches about the goodness of the Lord, about the importance of coming unto Christ. No church, no matter what its creed, can be responsible for the behavior of its members. And no member, no matter what her devotion, can be responsible for the creeds of her church. So what the Lord judges is the intent of our hearts, the degree to which we are willing to sacrifice for and love others, and how we act in the world on the knowledge that we have been privileged and blessed to have. Also, Joseph's statement seems to me to be at odds with another statement that he made. He says, it looks too much. When people came to him and complained about what one of the brothers in the church were teaching, he said, this looks too much to me like the Methodists and not like the Latter-day Saints. Methodists have a creed which a man must believe or be asked out of their church. That's not true of the Methodists these days, but it was true of the Methodists then. I want the liberty of thinking and believing as I please, Joseph said. It feels so good not to be trampled. It does not prove that a man is not a good man because he errs in doctrine. The High Council undertook to censure and correct Elder Brown because of his teachings. Whether they actually corrected him or not, I am a little doubtful, but I don't care. So I ask, which pleases the Lord more? A Presbyterian who believes in Calvinistic predestination but gives all he has to the poor? Or a Latter-day Saint who believes in free agency but who accumulates more wealth than he needs? A Quaker who sues for peace, or a Latter-day Saint, aware of the Lord's Latter-day admonition to renounce war, nevertheless is an avid supporter of war. A Muslim who believes in Sharia law, but who saves a starving Jew, or a Latter-day Saint who believes in the golden rule, but who cheats his neighbor. A Catholic who believes in the infallibility of the Pope, but who nurses an AIDS victim during his last days. Or a Latter-day Saint who believes President Hinckley is the Lord's authorized prophet, but who speaks disparagingly of homosexuals. In other words, it is our behavior, our actions, our openness to grace and love, our willingness to live the two great commandments, and not the creeds of our churches, that defines our discipleship. It is interesting to speculate as to which the Lord disapproves of most, those who have abominable creeds and live by them, or those who have correct creeds who don't live by them. And in truth, the creeds of the Latter-day Saints have not been without their falsehoods, and at times perhaps even their abominations. If one includes doctrinal pronouncements by living prophets, then a number of things spoken authoritatively by Brigham Young might fit into this category, as would the long-held belief that blacks were cursed and inferior and did not deserve the priesthood. Beliefs about women, about Indians, about homosexuals might also be considered abominable because of the harm they cause or at least allow. Beyond this, there are many other believers who live lives faithful to the central doctrines of their scriptures that are superior to the lives lived by some Latter-day Saints. In my own experience, I have friends and acquaintances who, though not subscribing to the doctrines I consider revealed, nevertheless follow Christ with a greater fervor and faithfulness than I do. I imagine this is also true for Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, and other believers in relation to their own creeds. We are told that we will be judged by living according to the light we have. President Hubie Brown said, we have been blessed with much knowledge by revelation from God, which in some part the world does not have. But there is an incomprehensibly greater part of truth that we must yet discover. Our revealed truth should leave us stricken with the knowledge of how little we really know. It should never lead us to an emotional arrogance based upon the false assumption that we somehow have all the answers, that we in fact have a corner on truth, for we do not. So, my experience in other churches has been a wonderful experience. Whether those churches have been Pentecostal, Southern Baptist churches I visited when I was a missionary in the Midwest, the South Midwest, Episcopal churches that I have visited in many parts of the world where my heart has been so touched by the devotion of other people and my awareness and understanding of God has been so enlarged by their Christian service and devotion to God. I was president of the University Religious Conference at UC Santa Cruz and interacted with people from a number of different faiths. And on one occasion when we held a retreat, we held it at a Catholic a retreat center. And I said to my good friend, Father Bunda, I said, I see around this lake there are the Stations of the Cross. Walk with me and teach me what those mean to you. And as we walked around the Station of the Cross, we stopped at one particular station where in that particular station there's Mary and Jesus on the cross. And he stopped and he said, I'm a Marianist, which means he belongs to the Order of Mary. And he said, every day throughout the world, the people of my order stop and we think about what it means to be at the feet of the cross. And we think about our lives in relation to that. And I thought of myself and thought, you know, I don't do anything like that. And I was very touched by Father Bunda's superior sense of worship. I visited St. Thomas Catholic Episcopal Church in Hollywood a couple of years ago with a dear friend of mine who is a Latter-day Saint and belongs to that congregation. I was amazed to find that there are 12 ex-gay Latter-day Saint Mormons who belong to that congregation. The organ in that church was built by a gay Latter-day Saint. The organist is a gay Latter-day Saint. The lay minister, the head of the lay ministry of that church is a gay Latter-day Saint. And I was struck by how this church had welcomed these Latter-day Saints into their congregation in a way that we haven't. I attend other churches on Good Friday and have with my wife and our family for many years because there's no place in the Latter-day Saint tradition to celebrate what happened on that day, which is the most important day in history, really. The day in which Christ took upon himself our sins. I remember Arthur Henry King, the great Shakespeare scholar who converted to the church, came to BYU, and he said to me, I couldn't believe it. He said, at BYU on Good Friday, they go to dances and they play baseball, and they do all kinds of other things. He said, that's the day my Lord died. And he was just astonished that we don't even think about that day. On Christmas Eve, we go to services in different churches. Last Easter, because we were having state conference, which I don't consider an appropriate Easter celebration, we went to Grace Cathedral in San Francisco and had a wonderful Easter celebration. I find that these churches, I remember an experience in Cambridge, England, where I went to Christ Church on a Sunday morning. There were only six people there. And the priest stood in front of us and he said, you know, we're just a small congregation. He said, I want you all to come up and surround the Lord's table. And as we came up, people from different traditions, and we stood around that table and he blessed the emblems of the sacrament and I partook of them with humility. I thought, this too is a sacred experience. When I went back to my congregation where I was a bishop and told them about this, several people were kind of scandalized that I would take the sacrament in another church. Whenever I'm feeling down, and I would suggest to you whenever you're feeling down, go to an African Episcopal Methodist church. You can't come out of there without feeling on top of the world and feeling that that God is in his heaven and loves hallelujahs. So let me close with a statement from Rumi. Rumi says this, if you think there's an important difference between a Muslim and a Jew and a Christian and a Buddhist and a Hindu and a shamanist, then you are making a division between your heart and your ability to act in the world. Now I believe that there are important differences between what I believe and what others believe. But I don't want there to be a division between what my heart feels and what my what my heart knows and how I act in the world. So I believe that in spite of important differences, what is at the heart of every religion is not different. That the highest form of worship is to love God with all of our hearts, minds, and souls, and to love others as we would want to be loved. Wherever we find these practices, we find fellowship. Thank you.
Well, to paraphrase what you might hear at the last session of General Conference, I have been spiritually fed, and you've heard what you should live by for the next 6 months. Are there comments or experiences? Please, yes, if you come up to the...
I wanted to tell about one experience I had as a teenager, a young teenager in the 33rd Ward in Salt Lake City. Our teenage class was interested in other religions. Our teacher said, let's go visit other churches. And so isn't this a stunning difference between, you know, our teacher said, and so we went about every third Sunday, we would get in cars, we went to the RLDS church, we went to the Unitarian church, we went to the Catholic church. And then we would come back and talk about it. And the message was, but of course there's things to be learned. But of course this is a wonderful thing. And I think we've lost that. I mean, I can't imagine that happening now. But for all of those you who know, Richard Craycroft was in that class, the same class. Some of you may know him. And Joseph Jepson, a.k.a. Rustin Kaufman, was the teacher of that class. And so I just thought that's a historical, something very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. Please, others. Yes.
Several years ago, I worked in sales with a gentleman who was a Christian convert from Judaism. And we were here in town and going to dinner and discussing some religious topics, and he said, have you ever received an answer to your prayers? And I said, well, not that I can really sink my teeth into, being an active Mormon. And he said, you know, the problem with you Christians is that you will pray and talk to the Lord, but then you don't shut up and listen for the answer. And that has always stuck with me, and how good a piece of advice that has been in my life. Because I find that afterwards, when I talk to the Lord and I stop and listen for an answer, how many great and wonderful answers I've received. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our church has an audition choral group in the Denver metropolitan area, the Colorado Mormon Chorale, and it was my privilege to serve for 8.5 years as president of the group. And during that time, we sang for Governor Romer's prayer breakfast 1 year, and we made it a point to sing something from Leonard Bernstein's Chichester Psalms and also a black spiritual. And at the conclusion of that event, Reverend Joseph Martin from the Macedonia Baptist Church, a black church that is, came up and said, oh, I would love to have you people come and sing in my church. Would you be willing to do that? I said, absolutely. And so we made arrangements, and then I went to the church, and everything seemed to be rolling along fine, but there's a lot of baggage that comes along with these things. And there were a number of people in Reverend Martin's congregation that rose up in wrath. We are not going to have these racist Mormons here. And Reverend Martin had unfortunately found it necessary to cancel our performance there, and I felt bad about it. He felt bad about it. I thought there was an opportunity to bridge or create bridges. So when I was talking with him in his office, he said, you know, it's important that we all work together to bring about the universal brotherhood and sisterhood of all mankind. And we just have to keep finding ways. And there was a spiritual communication there that I can't really describe. You would have had to have experienced it. But I said, you're absolutely right. We just have to keep at it. and tears started to come to his eyes and also to mine. And as we, pardon me, as we parted company, we definitely embraced each other. And I couldn't help but think at that time that that the really important things in life are, as you've said, Bob, love of God and love of fellow man.
Thank you.
I was just, I've enjoyed your presentation so much. I have the impression that at least later in Joseph Smith's life that he was, from reading church history, I think that he had an openness to other faiths in 1844 and 1843. And Brigham Young, if I recall from reading the Journal of Discourses, had an openness to other faiths. As I recall, didn't he invite other ministers and such to come in the tabernacle and preach and encourage people to encourage their children to come and attend the tabernacle? We're not without precedent, I don't think. But somehow or other, we don't seem to hold on to that precedent all the time. But I think there was a precedent in the church, and M. Russell Ballard wasn't the first, as far as I know. But I appreciated that information. But I don't remember that talk by Brother Ballard. 25 years ago?
No, he gave that more recently.
It was more recently.
The first presidency,
25 years. Oh, it was, yeah. Anyway, I've sure enjoyed your comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Others? Yes,
can I? Can I use that mic?
Yep.
I haven't run into anyone who's had the same experience I've had, especially within the Mormon Church, perhaps. I grew up going to church alone from a really young age, and hearing within my family hateful things about the church. My dad had grown up in Mormon and hated the Mormons. But I was able to attend Vacation Bible School at the Presbyterian Church. I had a Catholic boyfriend in high school and grew up in California, was able to attend Mass at the Mission, which is a lovely experience if you ever, been able to do without with the 19 archers or however many each of them has. I kind of do what John does on maybe a somewhat more informal basis, but make it my habit and practice to attend other churches. I love, we're on the 1-4 block schedule, 1-4 p.m., and so I can go in the morning, which most other churches meet, and then go to mine. It's eye-opening. Some of it's just entertaining, just because it's different from what I'm used to. I'm rarely entertained anymore at an LDS meeting. Not that that's what church is for, but when it's something new to you, I find that just intrinsically and somewhat entertaining and enlightening and educational. I think it's dishonest to say it's all positive. It's kind of been presented that way. Not every one of my experiences at other churches has been positive. One of the most uncanny thing has been how often, I was trying to put a percentage to it, I don't know if it's 60%, 70%, of the times I attend another church, something about Mormons is stated from the pulpit. That's weird to me. And I wonder if I'm sending out off some weird vibes. And if it ever, whenever it happens, I consider it a missionary opportunity. I always go to the pastor and say, I just wanted you to know that I'm visiting, I'm LDS, and I'm visiting your congregation. I was happy to be able to be here. I just want them to know that maybe we don't have horns, maybe we're more tolerant than they think, because I think from what they said, whatever they said, and it's not very positive, but that they would be surprised at the fact that I was there, and I want to make sure they know I was there. And there's some things I haven't done I still want to do. I have attended a bat mitzvah, but not a regular temple, whatever they call it, church. I haven't been to, is it the community, What is the RLDS now? I haven't been to the Community of Christ. I want to do that. I want to go to the church, I don't know what we call it, but the black LDS congregation that meets, I think, once a month in Salt Lake. And I want to attend there. So I definitely have some things. I've enjoyed the Quakers. We have a big church, non-denominational. My favorite one has been the non-denominational New Life Church, where there's the pastor may end up running for president and may even get elected president. He's rarely there because he travels so often, sometimes I'm sure to D.C. to talk to our current president. But I have spoken to him because he happened to preach one time when I was there, and I was able to talk to him, and I think he did make a Mormon reference, but I very much respect that church. And so the only other thing I wanted to say is that I have become, though I'm active in my own ward, I have become a part of the First Congregational Church and have a really close connection to them. I feel, maybe because I think they're the most intellectual group, or I sense that's how they come across to me, and maybe the most, they seem to have a concern for social justice. But they have a film group that I meet with. They meet once a month on a Friday, and we have potluck and watch a film and then have a discussion. I tend to be one of the most active members of the discussion afterward. And then during Lent, we meet every Friday, not just once a month. That's been a great experience. It's funny to be able to pass as a Congregationalist. They think I belong to that church, and it's just been such a good experience for building bridges, I guess, I feel. Not only what I've learned, but just to build bridges between people of different faiths.
Thank you.
This would be important.
Good, okay, because our time is up.
I hate to end this meeting on a sour note, but I want to tell you of two things. Within the last Christmas, when member of the First Presidency spoke in connection with the birthday of Joseph Smith, he recites the fact that Joseph Smith came home after his marvelous heavenly vision and said, Mother, I know for myself that Presbyterianism is not true. Now, I think that might have been okay for him to say with his mother, but I don't think this member of the First Presidency ought to have made that or quoted that statement in public over radio and television. That's a put down. And one of the things we have to avoid is put-downs. I hear people, young people especially, bearing their testimonies, saying, I know this is the only true church. And I, of course, as some of the panel has spoken here, that should not be. But we need to find ways to teach our people that we must avoid putting down people of other churches. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me remind you that tonight at 8 o'clock is the Pillars of Our Faith talk, and Phyllis is going to be on the program, so you don't want to miss that. Thank you very much for coming.